from Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Keeping the United Nations out. As the United States continues to bomb Yugoslavia, a look at U.S. arm-twisting at the U.N. to cover up what some call NATO's ecocide in Yugoslavia. Then we'll examine efforts by a human rights activist to remove a Honduran general now working at the U.N., accused of gross human rights violations. The U.S. makes record profits from the arming of dictators. And it's baseball diplomacy. Cuban exiles face off against Cuba solidarity groups as Cuba triumphs over the Baltimore Orioles. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. NATO struck a military airfield and destroyed a local television station in Yugoslavia, and many residents in Belgrade spent a second night in darkness due to a crippled power grid. Yugoslav media reported a NATO missile hit a bus full of women and children Monday in Kosovo, killing 20 people and injuring 43. However, NATO spokesperson Jamie Shea said today NATO commanders had made a thorough check of all gun cameras from planes operating in the area and interviewed all pilots. He said, "We can find no evidence of any involvement in this incident." NATO officials said the bus was traveling in an area known for heavy skirmishes between Yugoslav forces and the Kosovo Liberation Army. NATO has denied a number of civilian attacks in the past and had to retract its statement. And a Montenegrin government official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said it was NATO that struck the bus during the daylight attack on Monday. President Clinton dangled the possibility of a pause in NATO's air war against Yugoslavia and said he would be willing to negotiate the composition of an international peacekeeping force in Kosovo. Despite Clinton's tone in the face of new calls for a conciliatory gesture after Yugoslavia's release of three U.S. soldiers, officials said U.S. policy had not changed and the president vowed to press on with NATO's military campaign. U.S. officials said Clinton and Russian Balkans envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin had narrowed their differences over resolving the conflict during a 90-minute meeting at the White House yesterday, but there had been no breakthroughs toward a political settlement with Yugoslavian President Slobodan Milosevic. And in more news of the war on two fronts, United States jets attacked Iraqi air defense sites near the city of Mosul yesterday after being tracked by radar and fired upon by at least two surface-to-air missiles, this according to U.S. officials. An American statement from Incirlik said one of the surface-to-air missile sites was located in a civilian town. In a departure from usual practice in describing American air attacks on Iraqi air defense sites, the statement said the American planes, quote, did not target this site with bombs due to the potential of civilian casualties. The United Nations is worried that ongoing U.S. and British airstrikes on Iraq may hamper the distribution of aid in the country, this according to Hans von Sponeck, the most senior U.N. relief worker in Iraq. Von Sponeck toured Bashika, a town north of Mosul. A seven-member family and 250 of their sheep near Bashika were killed in an Allied air raid Friday, this according to the Iraqi Armed Forces. Von Sponeck also visited a Mosul neighborhood where the Iraqi government has said at least 14 houses were damaged and 20 people injured in another U.S.-British attack last Thursday. Mosul is 250 miles north of Baghdad. Von Sponeck told reporters yesterday, "I was deeply affected by what I saw, the total destruction of a shepherd's family and all their possessions." He went on to say, "I'm extremely sensitive to the effect of increasing airstrikes on the implementation of the humanitarian programs in Iraq." And this news from East Timor. A Nobel laureate has warned there will be more bloodshed unless the United Nations takes charge of security for an August 8th vote on its future. The warning came in a letter from José Ramos Horta delivered to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. In his letter, Timorese independence leader Ramos Horta, who shared the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize, expressed deep concern that the autonomy agreement doesn't contain security guarantees for a truly democratic process free of coercion and terror. Ramos Horta pointed to Indonesia's insistence on giving its security forces the primary role in keeping the peace and repeated allegations that Indonesian authorities are responsible for decades of killings and human rights abuses in East Timor. anymore. In a telephone interview from Lisbon, Portugal, Ramos Horta said, quote, there's ample evidence that the Indonesian military is orchestrating the violence in East Timor. The military aims to, he said, wreck the whole peace process and terrorize the people into accepting their domination. More than 100 people have died this year in attacks by death squads armed and trained by the Indonesian military in East Timor. And a victory for Panama's first woman president. She defeated the son of the army general who overthrew her husband 31 years ago. Ruling party candidate Martin Torrijos conceded defeat to coffee company owner Mariah Moscoso, who campaigned on pledges to slow the privatization of state enterprises and keep politics out of the operation of the Panama Canal. She's scheduled to accept control of the canal from the U.S. December 31st. Her late husband, President Arnulfo Arias, was ousted in a 1968 coup led by General Omar Torrijos Herrera. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. By broadening the scope of its airstrikes and attacking Yugoslavia's electrical system, NATO has crossed a threshold in the 40-day campaign with bombing that has had an immediate and widespread effect on Yugoslav people. NATO officials said the aim of the attacks, which plunged Belgrade into darkness for several hours, was to disrupt military communications, command centers, and air defense systems. While NATO sought to play down the effect of the attacks on civilians, the raids are extremely sensitive. Critics say the attacks on the electrical systems will not do lasting damage to Serbian forces because military systems are likely to be restarted again once the transformers are repaired. But if the attacks are repeated, they may force the closing of plants for water purification and sewage treatment, undercutting NATO's assertion that it's not at war with the people and undermining public support for the Allied campaign in the West. In an interview with the New York Times today, William Arkin, a military consultant to Human Rights Watch, said it will take a consistent effort to take out the national electrical grid that would have an onerous effect on civilians. As the bombing of Yugoslavia continues, a low-intensity war is being fought on the diplomatic front at the United Nations. The U.S. and its allies at the U.N. last week successfully blocked a Russian resolution critical of NATO for causing widespread environmental devastation in Yugoslavia. The resolution would have expressed grave concern over NATO's bombings of petrochemical plants and oil refineries in Yugoslavia, and called for the UN to undertake a comprehensive assessment of the environmental consequences of the bombing. Russia brought its complaint to the Commission on Sustainable Development, a UN body formed in the wake of the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio to address issues of environmental protection. Pacifica Radio reporter Jeremy Scahill has been following developments at the UN and filed this report.
The UN was sidestepped by the United States and its NATO allies more than a month ago as they began bombing Yugoslavia despite having no UN authorization. And now, 5 weeks later, member states opposed to the bombing are trying to use UN channels to stop the war. The newest battleground, the UN Commission on Sustainable Development. The Russian delegation last week put forth a resolution at the commission saying NATO's destruction of Yugoslavia's social and economic infrastructure has endangered the overall prospects for sustainable development in the Balkans. The resolution sought to express grave concern, particularly over the bombing of petrochemical plants and oil refineries. Talif Dean is UN Bureau Chief for Interpress Service.
The resolution specifically mentioned about the destruction that has taken place inside Yugoslavia, you know, the destruction to bridges, oil storage tanks, and, you know, and they are very, very critical in the resolution, and they said that considerable damage has been done to the environment, and they specifically want to condemn the NATO countries for doing this.
Among those countries supporting the Russian resolution was China, a vocal critic of the bombing of Yugoslavia. The Chinese representative to the commission spoke through a translator.
Mr. Chairman, we believe the draft resolution proposed by the Russian delegation has raised an issue that is closely related to the environment and sustainable development. We believe that the environmental deterioration in the Balkans is a fact. It should not be ignored due to political considerations. The CSD should be concerned about the global environment. It should not only discuss this question, but also take action to prevent the further deterioration of the environment in this region.
But the U.S. and its allies argued that the Commission on Sustainable Development was not the appropriate forum for addressing the environmental consequences of NATO's bombing and accused Russia of politicizing the U.N. Canada's representative to the commission rose to support a motion of no action, which would kill any debate on the issue. He speaks through a translator.
Mr. Chairman, the success of the work of the Commission on Sustainable Development is linked to the fact that this commission does not debate political matters. We feel that we ought not to diminish our success by debating questions which are in the context of peace and security.
In the end, the United States and its allies won out, grabbing the simple majority of the votes needed to block discussion of the environmental destruction caused by the bombing.
The result of the vote is as follows. In favor, 33, against 4, abstentions 8. The resolution is rejected.
But even though the U.S. was successful in passing a no-action motion on the Russian resolution, it could not silence nations wishing to express concern over the environmental consequences of NATO's bombing of petrochemical plants and oil refineries in heavily populated areas of Yugoslavia. India, which abstained on the vote, quoted extensively from a New York Times article about the bombings and pointed out the paper is, after all, considered the paper of record in the U.S.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to state that the problem that the Russian Federation has tried to address in its draft resolution is a matter of the gravest concern to the international community. On the 19th April, the Times, under the banner headline, Poison Cloud Engulfs Belgrade, reported that an ecological disaster was unfolding yesterday after NATO bombed a combined petrochemicals, fertilizer and refinery complex on the banks of the Danube, in the northern outskirts of Belgrade. It reported that among the cocktails of chemicals growing over hundreds of thousands of homes were the toxic gas phosgene, chlorine, and hydrochloric acid. Tons of a carcinogen, ethylene dichloride, had been released into the Danube and would flow downstream. This is not propaganda put out by either of the parties in conflict in the Balkans.
As countries began lining up after the vote to state their positions on NATO's airstrikes, the U.S. delegation was visibly disturbed at the prospect of a full-scale debate of the environmental impact of these bombings, and the U.S. representative tried to kill the discussion using procedural tactics.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My delegation understands that the purpose of the vote we just took was to close discussion on this item. Yet it seems that we're continuing to discuss the item. My delegation would hope that we would follow the rules that we have adjourned the debate, means that we stopped debating on this. Thank you.
These objections were eventually overruled, and Russia's representative rose to condemn what he called the Commission's failure to take on the issue of environmental disasters caused by NATO's airstrikes. He speaks through a translator.
We firmly believe that the CSD, as the main body of the UN dealing with sustainable development, has and should play a role in addressing the unfolding environmental disaster in Yugoslavia, with its unpredictable consequences to the lives of millions of people in Europe. The fact that the Commission turned its back on this issue does not mean that the issue has gone away. The truth is, and everybody knows, that the issue of the serious environmental consequences of the events in the Balkans exists, and that the time will come, and it will come very soon, when this issue will be on the agenda of the United Nations, including the CSD and other fora.
But the United States and its allies were bent on that not happening in front of the Commission on Sustainable Development.
Can I advise there are 7 other members of the Commission wishing to make a statement? I have a point of order from Germany.
Thank you,
you, Mr. Chairman. I had thought the idea of our motion was to end this substantial debate on this issue. Now we are in the middle of it. I would not interpret Rule 60 that it allows the whole discussion to take place after the vote. We have a clear vote to stop this, and I would please insist that the discussion on substance will be interrupted. Thank you very much.
The Russian resolution to condemn NATO was spurred by its attacks on the petrochemical plant in Pančevo in mid-April, as well as several oil refineries, including one in Yugoslavia's second-largest city, Novi Sad, which lies on the bank of the Danube River. Russia's foreign ministry last week charged that these attacks are causing harmful toxins to reach Poland and possibly Finland, and that in a matter of days they could stretch as far as Hungary, Greece, and Italy, posing environmental dangers to several European countries outside of Yugoslavia. Many countries at the UN are undoubtedly concerned about these NATO attacks, but in the end voted with the United States. And Talif Deen from Interpress Service says it's a result of arm twisting by the United States.
This has happened before, even in the Human Rights Commission in Geneva. So there are all types of pressure, subtle political pressure, economic pressure that is put on these countries, you know. Mm-hmm. And some of them are dependent on the United States or on Europe. On for various things, you know, for political reasons, economic reasons, military reasons. So what happens is they eventually cave in. And if they don't go along with the United States, at least what they do is they abstain on some of these politically sensitive issues.
Meanwhile, in a related development, Yugoslavia last week asked the World Court to declare NATO's attacks a violation of international law. Hearings on Yugoslavia's charges against the U.S. and nine other NATO countries are set to begin on May 10th in Geneva. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in New York.
And thank you very much for that report, Jeremy. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we're joined in the studio by Talif Deen, who is the United Nations Bureau Chief for Interpress Service, a third world news agency. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Talif Deen.
Thanks.
Well, let's continue this discussion about what's happening at the United Nations. What is the extent of the concern at the UN over the NATO attacks on petrochemical plants, oil refineries?
There's considerable concern at the UN, but as you pointed out in the report, one of the biggest tragedies of this war is that the United Nations has remained totally helpless. You know, in the Security Council, the Russians could not get through their resolution. And at the Commission on Sustainable Development, a resolution condemning the NATO bombing was virtually thrown out of the meeting, you know. So they are concerned. But as I pointed out earlier, there has been a lot of pressure put by the United States and by Western European countries. And there's a much broader and more complex issue. How sovereign and how independent are member states at the UN? Because when it comes to very, very sensitive issues, and when it comes to voting, I mean, they don't have a free hand to vote the way they wish to vote. Because the Americans and the Europeans not only put pressure at the United Nations, but they also exert a lot of pressure in the various capitals. And the instructions come from the ministry in the capitals, asking the ambassadors how they should vote. Either they should abstain or they should not vote against the resolution. And that's exactly what happened with the last voting at the UN. Hmm.
At the United Nations, the attitude right now, is it like the war is just passing them by?
It's exactly that's what's happening. The Secretary General has remained helpless. I mean, he has not been able to do anything at all because he has to get the approval of the, at least a sort of a consent of the five permanent members of the Security Council. That's the United States, Britain, China, France. And without any consent from them, there's nothing that the Secretary General can do on this issue.
Now, what's the relation between the Russia of the UN Security Council and Chernomyrdin meeting with President Clinton yesterday, the Russian envoy? Afterwards, Clinton said the bombardment of Yugoslavia will continue unabated despite the release of the three American military prisoners, as well as Russian efforts to broker a peace deal. Did you hear about this afterwards at the UN?
I did hear, and I was also told that Secretary General Kofi Annan himself had met the Russian envoy. But I don't know exactly what transpired at the meeting.
We're going to continue our conversation with Talif Deen, who is the UN Bureau Chief for Interpress Service, after stations break to identify themselves. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue day 40 of our War and Peace Report in Yugoslavia, our guest, Talif Dean, United Nations Bureau Chief for Interpress Service, which is a third world news agency. Afterwards, we'll be talking about the record year of U.S. arming of dictators around the world. And then we're going to be looking also at the United Nations, at a Honduran general who's on the payroll of the Honduran delegation, who's been accused of gross human rights violations, and one Honduran human rights activist who is trying to get him removed from his post at the UN. But right now, continuing on the issue of Yugoslavia, Talif Dean, Yugoslavia and the Russians have been reporting on the environmental devastation of the bombing. We're talking about thousands of bombs dropped on Yugoslavia, not just on Kosovo, and also the possible threats outside of Yugoslavia.
Right.
Can you talk about this report that came out last week?
The report, as you know, was put out by the Yugoslav government, and I also had the opportunity of talking to a diplomat from Yugoslavia, and he specifically mentioned this. And he said that the destruction was absolutely immense, enormous. And he was very much concerned about what was going to happen, not just to Yugoslavia, but also the toxic gases spreading across the borders of Yugoslavia into Europe. And he specifically mentioned Poland, and also that it could probably reach Finland. There's no way of confirming this, but if the resolution before the UN had been adopted last week, the UN Environment Program, which is a UN body dealing with the environment, would have gone to Yugoslavia to make an assessment of what was going on. Because the resolution was thrown out, there's no way for the United Nations or for any independent organization to assess exactly what the Yugoslavs are saying is happening to their country in terms of the destruction of the environment.
What is the U.S. saying at the United Nations about these reports of environmental devastation, what some are calling ecocide?
Yeah, of course, the U.S., as it did even in Iraq, has always dismissed this as propaganda, or they don't address the issue at all.
What are the countries that are backing up Yugoslavia and Russia in their concerns?
Just now, the few countries that are supporting Yugoslavia, besides Russia, are China, North Korea, Cuba, and India. And I was particularly surprised about India abstaining on that vote, because India has been very, very critical of the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia. But on this particular issue, I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know whether it was pressure put by the United States, but India admitted the fact that there is environmental destruction of Yugoslavia that is going on. But for reasons, of course, they said it's not an issue that should have been brought before the Commission on Sustainable Development. They abstained on this issue. So there are only a few countries which are openly supportive of Yugoslavia, but the others... They are sympathetic towards Yugoslavia, but they don't come out openly and support, as you could see by the voting that took place last week.
Do you feel like you live in two separate realities, one inside the United Nations hearing issues, for example, of
right.
environmental devastation, and then going home
right.
here in the United States and listening to the media reports? Well, they'll talk about bombing of oil refineries.
Right.
They rarely talk about what it means, for example, to bomb an oil refinery on the Danube to the greater Balkan area.
Right. Exactly. It's really two different worlds. You're perfectly right, you know. There's something that's going on in Yugoslavia, and the American public, I believe, most of them just do not know what exactly is going on, because what probably they read is what they read in the mainstream media, and what's going on in the UN is something totally different.
We're talking to Talif Dean, who is the UN Bureau Chief of Interpress Service, a third world news agency. What about the U.S. arm twisting behind the scenes to keep countries in line with support for the U.S. NATO bombing? For example, countries like Romania.
In fact, it's interesting you asked me about Romania, because the Yugoslav diplomat I was talking to last week told me, he particularly quoted the example of Romania, and he said that Romania had got quite a huge loan from the IMF, and they were expected to conform to certain conditions. And he said that they did not conform to most of the conditions, and they were not expected to receive a second loan. But he said the U.S. put pressure, as you know, they hold the largest share of votes in the IMF, and convinced the IMF that they should continue to give a second loan to Romania. And he said in that way, they silenced Romania. And Romania would not be taking a stand in favor of Yugoslavia.
What about other countries? That kind of arm twisting.
In fact, when you talk about arm twisting, if you talk in general, not just Yugoslavia, I remember a diplomat from one of the tiny countries in the Caribbean, of course, who wished to remain anonymous, who once told me that that whenever he speaks at the UN, he feels that as if that someone is looking over his shoulder. Because he said everything that we say and do at the UN is being monitored by donor nations. And they complain to our home countries. They complain to our foreign ministries, you know. And they put tremendous pressure on us. So we are not free to talk as the way we would like to talk or express our views.
My last question is about the UN authorizing the war against Yugoslavia. There's an interesting piece today in the Christian Science Monitor that begins, "Officially, the war in Yugoslavia is not a war at all. After more than 4,000 bombing runs, 1.5 million displaced people, and 6 weeks of reported rapes, killings, and burnings, it's merely a conflict. The word war has so many political and legal ramifications that the White House has made a point of never using it. President Clinton has even resorted to the awkward phrase at arms to describe America's military engagement in the Balkans." And at the end of the piece, it goes on to say, since its founding, the U.S. has deployed military forces overseas at least 200 times, yet only 5 times has it declared war. The War of 1812, the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and World War II. The Korean War was an international police action sanctioned by the UN. War evoked nuclear bombs, so the undeclared war in Vietnam was often called a containment strategy. The invasion of Grenada in the Reagan administration and Panama in the Bush administration were called military interventions. Is the U.S.-NATO bombing of Yugoslavia called war at the UN?
Technically, no, for this reason, because from the point of view of the international community, it's only the UN Security Council that can authorize a war. But in this instance, as you know, the UN Security Council, what happened was, the Russians wanted to put a stop to this, and the motion was defeated. So the UN Security Council did not authorize this war compared to what happened with the Gulf War. As you know, in Iraq, the Gulf War was authorized by the Security Council, but not this particular one.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and we will certainly continue to follow events at the United Nations. Do you think Kofi Annan plays any role? I mean, even if he did meet with Chernomyrdin right after President Clinton did, does he have any role anymore, the UN Secretary General?
The Secretary General's spokesman, a couple of weeks ago, when he was asked this question, he said that as long as he has no authority from the members of the Security Council, there's nothing that the Secretary General can do. In fact, the conventional wisdom at the UN is when it comes to a very, very sensitive political issue, the Secretary General plays the role more of a secretary than a general. And that's exactly what has happened in the war in Yugoslavia.
Talief Deen, thank you for being with us. Of the Interpress Service, a third world news agency, he is the United Nations Bureau Chief. Thank you.
Thanks.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with a look at United States' involvement with militarism abroad. Residents of a village in the Aceh province of Indonesia said today that the Indonesian military fired yesterday on an unarmed crowd that included women and children, killing at least 23 people and injuring many more. Meanwhile, José Ramos Horta, the spokesperson for the Timorese, has delivered a letter to Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, demanding that it not be the Indonesian army that monitors a referendum that will take place on August 8th, and also once again accuse the Indonesian regime of arming death squads in East Timor, which have been responsible for more than 100 deaths this year and continue to terrorize the people of East Timor. Well, Indonesia is just one of many countries named in a report released this past week by the group Demilitarization for Democracy that says that in 1997, the Clinton administration set a record for exports of arms and training of dictatorships around the world. In the case of Indonesia, which in 97 was still under the ruthless dictatorship of Suharto, the U.S. provided up to $20 million in military exports for that year. In fact, just tomorrow in the U.S. Congress, there will be two bills announced in the House and the Senate to cut off all further military interaction and support with the Indonesian regime. But the report from Demilitarization for Democracy, entitled Arms Uncontrol, identifies $8.3 billion in U.S. military exports to 52 countries that the State Department says citizens are not allowed to choose their government democratically. Caleb Rossiter is our guest, the director of Demilitarization for Democracy, and a one-time candidate for Congress. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Caleb.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Well, it's good to be with you. Talk about this report.
Well, it's remarkable that the United States, in its arms transfer policy, is continuing to create the conditions for future Serbias, meaning a tough government, well-armed with modern weapons, well-trained in modern tactics by U.S. personnel. Even as it talks about trying to restrain today's Serbian army. We found that 52 governments received this record $8.3 billion in U.S. military arms and training in 1997. Many of these probably will be future zones of conflict where the United States may be involved, and certainly citizens will be denied their right to democracy. It runs from Algeria to Zimbabwe, sort of A to Z. And in the middle, you have some tough, tough governments such as Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Sierra Leone even was receiving arms in 1997. It's just a real failure by the Clinton administration and Congress to put our principles, put our weapons where our mouth is and shut off arms to dictators.
Caleb Rossiter, we don't hear very much in the mainstream media, especially when you're just talking about Serbia, about U.S. involvement with arming these countries.
Well, for various reasons, decisions are always made to arm thugs and dictators. Usually the arms industry in this country, the Lockheed Martins and McDonnell Douglases, are putting huge amounts of money into the campaign finance system. You mentioned I ran for Congress. I was not a beneficiary of the $10 million in annual PAC contributions that the arms industry makes, obviously. They always managed to convince someone in the White House to find a reason. Now, in the case of Yugoslavia in the 1970s and 1980s, because Marshal Tito was not in the Warsaw Pact, was seen as keeping Yugoslavia independent as a communist dictatorship, the United States engaged in a large-scale arming and training of the Yugoslav armed forces, which today are essentially the Serbian armed forces, and yet we don't hear about this boomerang effect of our weapons coming back to haunt our interests and innocent civilians.
That's a phenomenon known as blowback.
And we have it all over the world. Our troops faced our weapons in Somalia, in Iraq. We have all these terrible civil wars in Africa, such as Zaire or Sudan, Angola, all of which received massive amounts of U.S. arms. And again, on one theory or another about how that was going to increase stability, but I think it's just commercial. The Clinton administration receives a huge amount of PAC contributions from the arms industry, and that really is what explains this phenomenal record they set in 1997 of $8.3 billion to dictators.
You have an idea where 1998 stands?
I think the trend is up. We have found this administration approving nearly anything that comes down the pike. For example, today, Amy, Turkey and Indonesia, there are two places where ethnic cleansing and slaughter of civilians demanding their legitimate rights is as extreme as it has been in Kosovo. And yet the United States there, far from intervening, as you know, is on the other side continuing the arming and the training. A program that we found this time called the Joint Combined Exchange Training Program really illustrates the problem we have with legislation that would constrain U.S. exports to dictators. Because Congress worked very hard because of human rights abuses in Indonesia and the denial of democracy to cut off what they thought was the military training program under the foreign aid bill. Well, what we found in our report is that 327 officers were trained in 1997. How could that be? Well, the Pentagon does it under a military exercise program that really no one had heard about until that year. They're always able to sort of slip it in some other side door. The legislation you're describing earlier would finally cut off that side door of joint combined exchange training programs to Indonesia.
In fact, I think it's Senators Feingold of Wisconsin and Leahy of Vermont who will be holding a news conference tomorrow to announce those bills in the Senate.
Well, I think for my money on this, Amy, Nita Lowey of the Bronx and Westchester, a congresswoman, is really the driving force because she's been pushing for a couple years for this legislation from her seat on the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, and I'm glad to see the senators get involved, too. That means we have a good chance. We also, of course, have our legislation based on the principle of no arms to dictators at all, which would be a great benefit to U.S. foreign policy and to the world. And that's all sponsored by Cynthia McKinney of Georgia and Dana Rohrabacher of California. But this year, again, Ms. Lowey is pushing it, and a New York congressman named Michael Forbes is really the target of this because there will be a key vote on a subcommittee he's a member of.
Also today, there is at 4 o'clock in the Rayburn House office building a Human Rights and Progressive Caucus briefing with Timorese who have escaped from the massacres of late of the Indonesian armed death squads in East Timor. But moving from East Timor and Indonesia to other countries, I think people might be surprised to hear what you had to say about Serbia, and I'd like you to elaborate on that, Caleb Rossiter.
Sure. Well, Amy, what happened in the 70s and 80s in Yugoslavia is very similar to what is happening today in countries as diverse as Morocco or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, Singapore. The United States exporting weapons to a tough dictatorial regime on a theory that it would improve regional stability or give us more contact with those officers or whatever the theory, we always find a reason to export the weapons. When Yugoslavia then fell apart, the modern United States weapons and the command and control training that we had delivered to the Yugoslav army, it's now in the hands of the Serbians. And that is a phenomenon that you see around the world. Most extremely, and this is what motivates many former U.S. military officers to support this arms trade code of conduct, no arms to dictators bill. We give our finest fighter planes and aerial refueling tankers and air-to-air missiles and command and control aircraft to these dictatorships. And what that does inevitably is permit Lockheed Martin to argue that we need the next generation, for example, what's now called the F-22 fighter plane, which will cost us $80 billion, because they've exported so many F-16s and F-15s to countries like Pakistan or Thailand or Singapore, Saudi Arabia, who are tough dictatorships who may fall apart in the future. It's an absolutely lunatic cycle of taking away our military advantages as well as arming dictators.
And we're talking to Caleb Rossiter, who is the head of Demilitarization for Democracy, which has just released a report which found a record $8.3 billion in U.S. weapon sales to dictators in the last documented year, which is 1997. If people want to get a hold of the report, Caleb, where can they call?
Well, a good thing to do is, since we're in the electronic age, go to our website, which is dfd.net, or certainly call us up in Washington, D.C. at 202-319-7191. And it's remarkable that you just had the Interpress reporter on with you, Amy, because as we try to get this story covered, we are finding, as usual, that these stories critical of United States militarization of the developing nations are only carried in Interpress. We can't buy coverage on National Public Radio, ABC, New York Times, Washington Post. They just don't consider it a story that we're arming dictatorship while we're saying we're sending troops to take care of the effects of another one. It's one of the most frustrating things in my 7 years of running Demilitarization for Democracy is that Interpress, Pacifica, frankly the only outlets of what is the most censored story in my years in Washington, which is the United States continuing to arm dictators.
Let's see. Could it have anything to do with Westinghouse owning General Electric? Westinghouse owning CBS, General Electric owning NBC, and they're the makers for many of the parts for the weapons that are used in Yugoslavia and elsewhere.
Well, certainly, and on the days, Amy, when I'm listening to see if our press release on this is reported on the say, National Public Radio News, before I can hear the news at the top of the hour, they say, this hour is brought to you, you know, by your friends at General Dynamics or Lockheed Martin, making the world safe for democracy. I just about put my fist through the mirror when I'm shaving when I have to hear that. But that's why I really appreciate the chance for us to get the word out here on Pacifica today.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Caleb Rossiter of Demilitarization for Democracy. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to take a look at baseball diplomacy. Cuba triumphed last night at the game over the Baltimore Orioles. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about what is happening at the United Nations. Why is a Honduran general still on the payroll of the Honduran delegation, a man who presided over gross human rights violations in the 1980s? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Demonstrators today end a four-day protest in Washington calling for the closing of the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, which has trained some of Latin America's most ruthless human rights violators. Almost 60 people were arrested yesterday in front of the Pentagon, and many protesters today head for Congress to lobby their representatives to support a legislative bill sponsored by Congressmember Joe Moakley of Massachusetts to close down the school. And last week, Congressmembers Tom Lantos, Democrat of California, and Connie Morella, Republican of Maryland, reintroduced the Human Rights Information Act, which would establish a secure and fast system to the release of information by the U.S. government on human rights atrocities committed in Honduras and Guatemala in the 1980s. Well, among the graduates of the School of the Americas is General Luis Alfonso Discoa Elvir, the former chief of staff of the Honduran Armed Forces. He briefly headed the notorious CIA-trained Battalion 316, which is responsible for scores of disappearances and extrajudicial executions during the 1980s. General Discoa now lives in Miami, and he's a member of the Honduran delegation to the UN in New York. Well, we're now joined by a man who's here in New York to denounce Discoa and to have him removed from the UN delegation. Dr. Ramon Custodio joins us. He is director of the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights in Honduras. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to declare publicly that he shouldn't be a member of the United Nations as a delegate from Honduras State because he's got a very, very bad record in human rights violations, and the government in Honduras knows it. We have made it public, and we have made public protest of this, and also came to New York 3 years ago before he came to New York, and I couldn't get any results to stop him.
So what are you doing here?
I'm renovating the case. I am presenting new documents to support our affirmation that he says human rights violators, some cases directly and some other cases when he was he presided the Battalion 316 organized under the pressure of the USA government back in the 80s in Honduras.
We're also joined by Susan Peacock, who's a research fellow at the National Security Archive specializing in Honduras. And together with the Honduran human rights ombudsman, Leo Valladares, she co-authored the report In Search of Hidden Truths, which documents human rights abuses in Honduras in the 80s, including the disappearance of close to 200 people. Susan Peacock, your information on General Discoa.
Well, Discoa is one of the 19 Honduran military officers that we mentioned specifically in the Honduran government's request for information from the CIA and the Defense Department. The only Pentagon document that we received in response to that request told us that he received a military intelligence officer's course at the School of the Americas in Panama. Another State Department cable tells us that immediately after completing his stint as the commander of Battalion 316, this notorious death squad, he went off to the U.S. Military Intelligence School at Fort Huachuca. So this is a man who has been prepared very carefully by the U.S. for his work, and the U.S. knows as well the nature of his activities and his involvement in human rights abuses, but has not been willing as yet to share that information with Honduran authorities or with U.S. citizens.
Hmm. If the Human Rights Information Act were passed, it was introduced once again last week, would the U.S. be forced to reveal these documents?
The Human Rights Information Act would set up an appeals panel and a process by which the excisions in the documents that we've received to date could be reexamined, and opens up the possibility that the appeals panel could overturn the previous rulings of censors at U.S. agencies. So it would be a very positive step for us.
Dr. Ramon Custodio, as I said in the introduction, this man, General Discoa, who headed the Battalion 316 on the Human Rights Watch website, they described 316 as a clandestine military death squad originally trained and equipped by the CIA, synonymous with torture, murder, and disappearance in Honduras. We said that General Discoa is actually living in Miami. So how is he a member of the UN delegation here in New York?
That's something that we are going to request an explanation from our government, because we think it is a case of corruption. He's got a salary for a post that he doesn't perform, and also his wife is assistant of him, and we have to find out whether his wife has also a salary.
Question: if he's at the UN and he's on a full salary, and he's part of the diplomatic mission, does that give him diplomatic immunity?
Yes, theoretically, yes. He's got that immunity, and it is a case of impunity, too. We are showing the way how some states use the diplomatic channels to produce impunity. And impunity, it is also disobedience of the Honduran states, because the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ordered the state to investigate all violations of human rights that occur in the country between 1981 and 1984, which includes General Discoa's performance as commander of Battalion 316.
Would you like to see Discoa tried or sued? I mean, would you like to see something like what is currently happening to the Chilean dictator, Pinochet, in Britain?
We have mentioned him before several cases before the Honduran tribunals, and we are also exploring the possibility for an international trial, just taking the example of General Pinochet in London.
General Ramon Custodio, you are running possibly for president in Honduras. What is this, your mission here, to point the finger at General Discoa and have him removed as a member of the UN delegation from Honduras, have to do with your presidential aspirations?
Nothing at all. I think I am putting an end to a long service in human rights field. I've been an activist and advocate since 1981. And when we face cases like this, General Discoa having diplomatic immunity, I feel that we must go into office. And that's why I decided to run for office as an independent candidate, meaning that I am not committed or compromised with any traditional power in Honduras.
Do people in Honduras understand what Susan Peacock just told us, and that is this issue of the United States not releasing documents about Battalion 316, which is quite notorious in Honduras?
We have made an effort within Honduras to reveal the secret files of the Honduran army. I always insisted that most of the truth is in the Honduran files, not in the CIA secret documents. And that the declassification has a very, very many limitations, because they delete at least 95% of the information.
We're talking to Dr. Ramon Custodio, who is director of the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights in Honduras, in New York, attempting to have General Luis Alfonso Discoa Elvir, former chief of staff for the Honduran Armed Forces, who headed the notorious 316 Battalion in 1984, to have him taken off of the Honduran payroll as a member of the UN delegation and also stripped his diplomatic immunity. Again, this comes at the same time as the School of the Americas protesters are in Washington, D.C. Discoa was a graduate of the School of the Americas. Susan Peacock on the line with us as well in Washington, D.C. from the National Security Archives. I wanted to change the topic for a moment to the issue of Cuba, Susan. That issue is this. We've been watching some Cuba baseball diplomacy taking place. There were 24 official hits during the Baltimore Orioles' second meeting with Cuba's baseball team last night, but the most memorable was anti-Castro. Way through Cuba's 12-6 win over the Orioles, umpire Cesar Valdez struck and body slammed the demonstrator. You were there. What was the ball game like?
Well, it was an exciting game despite a steady downpour and the Cuban team was far superior to the Orioles, I believe, in their skills. There were a lot of different views expressed in the crowd. I think we made history last night in Baltimore.
Were there many Cuba solidarity activists as well as anti-Castro Cubans there?
There were, but it was difficult for people on all sides to get the message out because of the weather, I think, and the steady rain coming down. And as we entered the stadium, we were checked to see if we were carrying posters, T-shirts with slogans and that kind of thing, and those were taken away from people to avoid situations like that that occurred on the field.
It's interesting, in all the TV news coverage of the game last night, there was no coverage of the anti-U.S. blockade protesters who were at the Orioles game.
Well, it's surprising, but it's not. I think that most of the coverage was of the folks who came up from Miami for the game, who were very much anti-Castro and didn't feel that the game should have been taking place.
There's also an interesting sort of side story to all this. I'm looking at the Christian Science Monitor today, and it says officials at Miami International Airport lifted a ban on sales of the latest issue of Cigar Aficionado magazine, which had been taken off shelves because it was deemed flattering to Cuban President Fidel Castro. The Miami-Dade County Mayor, Alex Penales, had called the move a form of censorship. The June issue, which questions the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba, was ordered off all airport newsstands late last week. Not a lot of coverage of anti-U.S. blockade activities.
No, nor is there coverage of the facts that last week the embargo against Iran, Syria, and Libya was lifted, but Cuba's remains in place.
You know, that's interesting you should raise that, because I've heard people refer to the blockade against Iraq lifted, confusing it with the blockade against Iran. Can you just touch on that for a minute, expand on an issue that we haven't really dealt with on Democracy Now!, this lifting of the blockade against Iran?
Well, to be quite honest, I don't know much about it, but I understand that there's a large grain sale pending to Iran and that there may be a connection between that and the timing of the lifting of the embargo.
Dr. Ramon Custodio, since you will be running for president in Honduras, is one of your issues going to be the relationship with Cuba? For example, what is Honduras's relationship with Cuba, and does the U.S. intervene?
Right now, there is a representative of the Cuban interest down in Honduras. I think that every state should define its own foreign policy. And if there is any kind of intervention, it has to be multilateral and authorized by the United Nations forces only.
I was wondering if you were going to say there by the United States.
No, I don't think any bilateral intervention is advisable, because we Latin Americans know that we have been victimized by that kind of policy.
Finally, Dr. Ramon Custodio, going back to the main issue that you're here about today, and that is General Discoa. If people want to be involved with your campaign to have him stripped of his diplomatic immunity and lose his position in the Honduran delegation, is there somewhere they can call or get information?
Yes, I think that any information should be asked from the National Labor Committee here in New York, and they are our correspondent. And we also have a telephone line, 504-237-7825, which is the telephone of our committee, or our fax is 233.
We'll stick with just the phone number.
Okay.
And this is in Honduras?
In Honduras.
That phone number is 504.
For the country code.
237-7825. And Susan Peacock of the National Security Archives, the website for your archives, which is quite remarkable in the amount of documents it has on it, from Guatemala to Honduras to Cuba to many other issues.
Yeah, our website is www.ces.gwu.edu/NSArchive. And you'll find on that website several declassified CIA documents about Battalion 316.
Susan Peacock, thanks for being with us, as well as Dr. Ramon Custodio. That does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our headlines editor, Michael Eid. Special thanks to Jeremy Scahill. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Our engineer today has been Bernard White. Thanks for listening.